mentioned, Esther, that about the 10,000 solar points, because I want to know how bad the situation is. Can you say in other pshatas to let her know that he didn't get anything from Haman, and once he didn't get anything, so now it's easier? Because once he has something, he has to return the 10,000 golden coins and then retract. It's much harder to give back once you have it. Right? If he accepted something, so now we're on better. So it doesn't seem so good because he wasn't saying good things. According to the whole shot, it wouldn't make sense because it looked like he was more.
He wants desperate. That's right. Furthermore, if you know anything about how bribes go, you know, if he gives you a bribe, he gives you a bigger bribe. So you can have bribes. It goes to the highest bidder. I doubt it. I doubt it. As a friendship, I doubt it.
Sylvie.
Yes, sir.
What's up, dude?
Not broke.
You know what it is? It's probably because I watch TV my whole life. Like every day. It's all American TV. So it could have been I just picked it up from watching TV.
Could be. Okay.
I never read a book until I came to Israel. A golf book. It's a golf book, of course.
So you were expelled from third grade, never went back to school?
I was expelled grade 10, almost kicked out in grade 9.
But, you know, you must have read something in order to stay in school, no?
Probably.
Never read a book?
I remember I once did a book report in grade 7, and the book did not exist. The author, I made up the author's name. It was like I was in a play, I was in some play. So I made up one of the guys who was in the play. I used his name, and I made up this whole play. I made up this whole story. I never read the book. I got like a really good mark.
Once you know, there's a very famous South American author and thinker and sort of philosopher, and he wrote a book called Reviews of Non-Existent Books.
I never finished high school, so.
I see.
And before high school, you didn't have to really read anything. So.
When I was teaching college, about the sixth week into a course, one of the students came in to me and said he wants to discuss this topic for his term paper. So I said, it's a little early, isn't it? I mean, it's a 14-week course. Usually come in around week 9 or 10. He said, well, if I decide on the topic now, then I don't have to read anything else. I just have to read what I have to read for the topic. I was so naive in those days, I thought that was like, you know, very surprising. Okay, we're on page 1256.
Parakei,
chapter 5. So she now, Esther now, is prepared to do what Mordechai says, to go into the king and to plead for the Jewish people. And she has told Mordechai to assemble all the Jews be found in Shushan and fast. Do not eat or drink for 3 days. And then I'll go in. Now, I just want to point out, it's going to be over and over again. She says, assemble all the Jews. Here you have a kind of subtext, an underneath theme. What did Haman say about the Jews?
That they were scattered, dispersed people.
They're scattered. And the way you overcome that is to bring everybody together. You'll see over and over again that this is a theme, that there's a stress on the unity of the Jewish people because, as I told you, the fact that they were scattered was not just geographical. The geographical spread was a symptom of an inner disunity. And the antidote is to create a kind of unity. After all, if all the Jews in Shushan are fasting for Esther and praying for her, what do they have to be assembled for? Each one could be in his own house, fasting and praying. But here it's a larger issue of counteracting the true accusation of Haman that they were really disunified. Okay, now, came to pass after 5 on the third day. Esther put on royalty, which means she put on her royal garments. I'm going to translate it from Hebrew.
Was this also, I'm sorry,
chapter 5, verse 1.
Was this also to say that she dressed herself up to be alluring to
Ahasuerus? No. No.
Because I think the whole idea of her not being called in for the past 30 days was as if to say, he only called me in for one reason, and I haven't been called in for 30 days, so I know he's bound to call me soon, and when she decides to dress up, she dresses up in an attractive, alluring fashion. I thought that's... Not that I heard that from someone, but I just...
That's certainly not what the words say. Furthermore, she's going in uncalled. So he's doing other things. So what's she going to do? Go in and seduce him? I mean, what's the point here? She
certainly has an influence.
She does.
She's one of the most beautiful women in history.
Well, maybe so, but it's interesting. It doesn't mention that. What it mentions is that she is... when he chooses her, yeah, it says he loves her, loves Esther more than all the women, and she found chen and chesed. Chen is a kind of charm, and chesed means loving kindness. That's what she called out of him. Doesn't say anything here about physical attractiveness. And there are words that indicate physical attractiveness in Hebrew, but doesn't say anything about that here. Yeah.
Could have been the fact that she's coming to see Ahasuerus, and she never goes really out of the way to see her. Plus, she dressed up really, you know, nicely, so that just her mere presence in the court could be like, wow, well, you know, like, well, she's not the queen, you know, she looks better today than she.
Yeah, but look, the words are, the words he asked on are, she dressed in royalty. She dressed in royalty. So that royalty means king. She dressed like a queen.
But it's different than what she was doing before then, obviously. Why would I mention it?
I know you're sort of coming in the middle. I mean, you haven't been here the last few days, but we're talking now about her coming in when she wasn't called to come in, into the inner courtyard, place where by law you're not allowed to go. This has never happened before. This has never happened before. This is not relevant to anything that happened before and anything that's going to happen afterwards. It's an absolutely unique event. It says nothing about her general style of clothing when she went to see him, if she ever went to see him, or that's not relevant here. The question is, she's going in now against the law to a place where the law is that you should die. How does she go in? So it says she went in with the apparel of a queen to look like a queen. She stood in the inner courtyard facing the chamber of the king, and the king is sitting there on his throne facing the door from the inside. So they're facing each other. And it was when the king saw Esther, the queen, standing in the courtyard, again, Nosachin, she found grace in his eyes, charm in his eyes. Same word, charm. Charm, I told you, that's that inexplicable feeling that's like being bewitched, enchanted. And for no reason that you can put a finger on. You're attracted, you gravitate in that direction. Not for any particular reason. So he sticks out his scepter to her, and Esther draws closer, she touches the end of the scepter. He says to her, Esther the queen, what is your request? Up to half the kingdom, and it shall be given to you. Now this phrase repeats over and over again in Miguel's Esther. One of the commentators, maybe it was the Mamas, this idea, up to half the kingdom. Is he seriously saying, well, there's 127 provinces, so I'll give you 63. Right? I will give you 64, that's Rome, but I'll give you 63. Is that what he's really saying? I'll give it away to you? That's not what he's saying. The message here is, I'm happy to do whatever you like. Don't do anything that disturbs the stability of the kingdom. If it's less than half, anything that's less than half, as we know in law, and even a thought, it can is overwhelmed by the more than half. Meteorisa, Buffel Barov, things, most things are nullified when they're mixed into a mixture of something that's more than it. So he's telling her, I'm happy to grant you whatever you wish, but make sure that what you ask for does not destabilize things. I don't think he knows what she wants. After all, don't forget, she's to a certain extent a mystery to him. He doesn't know who she is. He doesn't know what her background is, what her people is. There's something mysterious about her, but he's sort of giving in to the charm, but saving himself and saying, listen, I'm going to pass judgment on it, and it's up to this limit, but no more. Now, Esther says to the king, if it is good, I think the best translation is if it pleased the king, she says, im alamalach tov, if in the king's judgment it's good, let the king and Haman come today to the banquet that I have made for him. And as I told you, all the way through, mishteh means drinking party. Drinking party, the food is there so that you don't get a bad stomach. But mishteh means a drinking party. As against sudah, a sudah is really something based on food at which you may drink also. It's like a celebration. He has no idea what she's celebrating, but that's so, King says, get Haman moving quickly to do what Esther says. And the king and Haman come to the party which Esther made. And the king understands that she didn't just come to invite him to a party. She has something else in mind. King says to Esther at the wine feast. Now he doubles his language here. And he repeats the double language a number of times subsequently. What is your Sheila? And it will be given to you. What is your Bakasha? Up to half of the kingdom. And it will be done. And it's very exact. A Sheila is a request. A Bakasha is more a petition. A Sheila would be personal. Something you want for yourself. And a bakasha is a petition that you might have on the, save the whales or, some other interesting project. Now look what he says. What is your Sheila? It will be given to you without any conditions. What could you want? Diamonds? Another palace? Sundays off? Whatever you want, you can have it. But if it's a bakasha, it means a petition. There it could have social significance or political significance, then I'm putting on the qualification up to half the kingdom. In the previous statement, in verse 3, he only used the word bakasha. And there he says up to half the kingdom. So the half kingdom goes together with bakasha, because bakasha includes something that will have social ramifications. Sheila is personal. There he doesn't put any limit on it, because what's she going to ask for herself? 6 provinces to own? That's not what the queen's going to ask for. So he doesn't have to put a qualification. And Queen Esther says, watch, my Sheila and my Bakasha. You got it right, King. You got it right. I want both. I have a personal request to make, and I have a petition to make that will be of political significance. I have both. Now she says a very enigmatic statement. If I have found favor in the king's eyes, grace, charm in the king's eyes, and if it's in the good in the king's judgment, to give. Look at this. Look at the words. To give my Sheila and to do my Bakasha. That's exactly what he said. She's copying his language exactly. He said, in verse 6, Ma Sheila Seich v'yi nosein loch, what is your Sheila and it will be given to you? Ma Bakasha Seich v'seos, what is your Bakasha, it will be done. So she says, if it's good in the king's eyes, if I found charm or grace in the king's eyes, and it's in the king's judgment to give my Sheila and to do my Bakasha, it's exactly parallel. Let Haman, have the king and Haman come tomorrow to the party that I shall make for them, and tomorrow I will do according to the king's word. Now, there are two surprising things here that need explanation. First of all, what does she mean? I'll do according to the king's word. What word is that? What has she not been doing up until now? In the book, there isn't a clue. In the book, there isn't a clue as to what she's talking about here. Well, what is she going to do tomorrow? What is she going to do with the second party that could conceivably be the element of doing according to the king's word? Tomorrow, she's going to ask that the king shouldn't destroy the Jewish people. That's not according to the king's word. That's not what she owes him. That's not what he's been asking for. What is there? I mean, of course, you know the answer, but instead, what am I doing now? I'm explaining to you where Chazal got the answer from. They got the answer from this. Here she says, I'm going to do according to the king's word, and there's a clue here what she means. Now, okay, what is it tomorrow that she's going to do?
She's going to tell him where she's from.
Right, she's going to tell him that she's Jewish. That's the only thing that she does tomorrow that the king could possibly have any interest in. Right? Because she's going to ask that Haman be destroyed, and she's going to ask that the Jews be saved, and that's not anything that he's been asking her to do for years, or even for 10 weeks, that she hasn't been doing. So from here you see that this was a bone of contention between them. So what I told you when Achashverosh brought in the second group of virgins, I told you that was to frighten her because he wanted to know who she was, and I told you he made the reductions in taxes for the whole empire, and he gave gifts to the whole empire. I said that was to stimulate people to talk about it. Maybe it'll come out who she is. If you interpret those things that way, then you understand the background for her saying, I'll do according to the word of the king. And you see that the following day, the only thing she does is reveal that she's Jewish. If not, these words are absolutely unintelligible. Okay, this should teach you that when you have a chazal, when chazal tells you something, it's usually based on a deep analysis of the book. It's not just words to file away the spare time.
Yeah. Second day of Pesach?
Oh, so now, that's what I'm coming to. Which day is this? This is the second thing that's going on here. Which day is this? Well, how does chapter 5 start? Third day of the fast, right? She said, fast for me for 3 days. And this is the third day of the fast. You see something a little odd here? On the third day of the fast, what does she do? She makes a party. She invites the king and Haman. And at the party, what does she do? What's the whole thing she does on the third day of the fast? Invite them for tomorrow. Tomorrow, what's going to be? Are they going to be fasting tomorrow?
No.
No, it's a 3-day fast. Tomorrow, after the fast is finished, when they're already eating and drinking, right, and relaxed, then she's going to ask for the Jewish people to be saved. I wouldn't do it that way. I would never have done it that way. Isn't the climax when you come in and say, please reverse the decree, please don't kill out the Jewish people, please save them? If it was up to me, I would have come in the first time and the second day. That's the minor thing. Come in and invite them for tomorrow. And then on the third day, when it's the crucial moment, and everybody will have been fasting for 2.5 days, or at the peak of the fast, that's the time to ask for the salvation. And she doesn't do it that way. So, before you come to an explanation, what do you have to infer? The first step in logic. What is her position? You don't know why she took the position, but what is the position? What is she saying? What is her grasp of the situation? Everything depends upon getting in. Everything depends upon getting in. If I get in, if he says yes, if he lets me in, it's all over. Then I know I'm going to be successful. I don't know how she knows that, but that's her position, clearly. So she waits to the most powerful moment, the moment where she has the most merit, where the Jewish people is functioning in the best possible way, to go in just to ask that he should come tomorrow to another party. Because she knows somehow that if she can get past that barrier, then she's home free.
She herself said that if she's destroyed, she's destroyed. The last end of the last
yes.
paragraph.
Therefore, I don't see how it connects with what I'm saying. Her goal here now is not to throw away her life. Her goal is to save the Jewish people. It's not a question of, well, I'm willing to die. Willing to die is not the goal. The goal is make it work and stay alive. Right? So now, it seems to me, if the whole goal is to change the king's mind,
to get him to revoke a decree, which is not so simple, right? And that's the crucial thing when you tell him, listen, I know you sent out these messages, and I know it's sealed with your seal, and I know it's a real decree, but I want you to take it back. That, to me, would be the hardest thing to achieve. If that's the hardest thing to achieve, you'd want it to be at the height of the Jews fasting and praying and doing tshuva. No. You wait till the next day when everybody's relaxed. They've been eating, they ate last night, and, you know, after 3 days and nights, I imagine they eat quite well, right? And they're more relaxed. And now's the time when you go in. That's not an obvious strategy. She obviously feels that if she can get past the barrier, then the rest of it will be okay. The question is, why does she feel that way? Now, I don't know, and I certainly can't prove it on the basis of anything in the text. Just you should notice that that's her grasp of the situation. But here, the rabbi says something which we will talk about more, assuming we have time, that every time in the book it says, the king, without the word Achashverosh, just the king, it has a double reference. It, of course, refers to that shlub, that no good, but it also refers to God, refers to both. When she talks, she's talking in two directions at once. When she prays, when she pleads, she's pleading in two directions at once. When she comes in front of the doorway, and he sees her, she sees him, and it's a question now of being allowed in or not allowed in, it's not just a question of this flesh and blood creature sitting there, but it's a question of whether or not the Kodesh Baruch Hu has agreed to turn the providence around and to allow them to exist. So that could be part of it, that she feels that if she gets past this barrier, I mean, it's a sign that from heaven that they're willing to allow her project to succeed, and then the project will be carried out. Of course it will be carried out. That's a crucial thing. Will he let me in or won't he let me in? And as you see back here in the beginning of the chapter, it says, HaMelech, the king, without the word of Achashverosh. So, that means it's the double reference. She has one eye looking up and one eye looking straight forward, and she's working at both levels at once. Okay. Now, this one's over. 9. Haman went out that day joyful, with a good heart. Now let's just picture this guy, right? He's the prime minister. He's fabulously wealthy. The king recently, a few days ago, gave him his ring to carry out a matter of public policy at his own, judgment. And he's wealthy. He's got everything. The only thing is he isn't king, but other than that, he's really got everything. And he and the king alone are invited to this party with the queen. Really puts him in a position like a crown prince. You know, he's higher than everybody else in the kingdom, except for the king himself. So he goes out, joyous and with a good heart. And when Haman sees Mordechai in the gate of the king, who doesn't get up and doesn't move from him, is not affected by him, Mordechai is not affected by Haman, Haman is filled with anger at Mordechai. And he holds himself back. He restrains himself. He comes to his house. And he sends and calls his friends, Ohavav, his friends, and Zeresh, his wife. We'll see that there's a question here, how she functions vis-a-vis the friends. Notice it's the friends first and Zeresh second. The order will change and things will go back and forth. I'm just pointing it out. And Armand says to them, he recounts to them, he describes to them the honor of his wealth and the greatness of his children, and that all that the king raised him up and made him big and put him above all of the officials and the servants of the king. And Haman says, even Esther the queen didn't bring anybody else to the party that she made for the king, except me. And tomorrow also I am called by her with the king. And all of this is not worth anything to me. All of this is not worth anything to me. All times when I see Mordechai the Jew sitting at the king's gate. Like, you know, this guy is not normal. This guy is not normal. He has everything. So that Jew doesn't get up. So what? So what? Okay, it's not nice. And okay, it's irritating. Can that one little thing deprive you of your whole life? Just because that Jew doesn't get up? You'll ask a psychiatrist about this. The guy's sick. The guy's sick. He's incapable of enjoying anything that he has. Just because, I mean, it's not like Bill Gates, you know, walks into a room and one guy doesn't stand up to honor him. He says, oh, my $68 billion are worthless to me because this guy doesn't get up. You know, that would be sick. And Gates isn't number two to the president, and he isn't, you know, he's just got a lot of money, that's all. So you can look at this as an insight into Haman's character, that he can be undone by something as little as this. One of the Talmidim here in the yeshiva about 10 years ago said a pshat here, which I think is absolute gold, beautiful and very deep. Look at the words, he says. He says, all this is not worth anything to me. Any time when I see Mordechai the Jew sitting at the gate of the king. Mordechai the Jew sitting at the gate of the king. And as I just told you, the king, without the name Achashverosh, refers also to God. So the Talmud said, the goy, with all the money and power and influence and fame in the world, knows that he's missing out. He's missing out on what really counts. No, a goy has a soul also. A non-Jew has a soul also. What? Wait till the end of the chat. Maybe I don't see how it's relevant. So he says the goy feels that all of this, the money, the power, the reputation, all of it is worth nothing in comparison to being close to the king. Capital K. Being close to the king. He tries to blind himself to that. He tries to preoccupy himself with that. But deep down, the soul knows that all of that is like a child getting more and more plastic toys. Look how many, I have 1,000 plastic toys! You know, that is not going to impress a 13-year-old who can make money. So he's like, I got another 1,000 or 2,000 plastic toys. You know, now deep down, he sees that it's only plastic toys. You know, and this guy's got a bank account, he can buy all the plastic toys he wants. And that guy's got something for which he wouldn't trade all the plastic toys in the world because it's something worth much more than plastic toys. So deep down, he knows he's getting a raw deal. He's getting a raw deal because in the end, this really doesn't count. Isn't that clever, Shem? It's a beautiful, beautiful Shem.
It's a number you'd remember.
If he's happy with
whatever
he gets, his abilities, if he's fulfilling 65, then he's getting
close to
that. So
who's talking about fulfilling
65?
We're talking about
Haman
now.
Right, Haman can also do the Jew, but even if he's not a Jew, they can get close to that.
All I said was that the non-Jew, when he looks at his power and his money and his fame and all of that, he realizes that that's not where true value lies. So if you've dedicated your life to that, as Haman did, that's what your life is about. His life isn't about the 65 commandments that non-Jews have to do. His life is about money and fame and power. Then you see a Jew who you can feel is closer to God, you realize that what you've dedicated your life to is really worthless. That's not a nice feeling. And I can understand why I would undo someone like Haman. And it undoes him doubly because he doesn't want to feel that way. He'd rather pretend to be satisfied with what he has. Shall I put all my cards on the table? This is exactly why frum Jews irritate non-religious Jews. They really irritate them. They make them nervous. You get the most drastic responses to your being religious from non-religious Jews. He will find non-Jews much more kind and accepting, much more relaxed about it, whether they're religious or non-religious. You won't drive them up the tree like you drive the non-religious Jews up the tree. Because deep down, the Neshama is telling them, he's got it. He's got it, and you don't have it. What drives Tommy Lapid around the bend, him and all his friends? He's a one-issue party. All he cares about is killing the Haredim. That's all he cares about. That's his whole platform. And now he's in a position to carry it out. Right? You know, as Jonathan Rosenblum wrote, you have a country here that's suffering from very, very serious problems, very serious challenges. Iraq, the rest of the Arabs, the failing economy, social problems. How could a man with a one-issue party stick it to the Haredim get so many votes? These people are running away from the reality. They can't face the reality. Why isn't there a serious debate about real issues? Why aren't these 15 votes being given to some real issues that could help the country? Not to mention the fact that their complaints are false. Jonathan had an article quoted from Haaretz, a guy named Caspian Haaretz, who documented that all the criticisms are false. But leave that aside. These people are running away from the reality because they can't face it. They just can't face it. Now that's, in a way, the theme of the non-religious Jewish social policy is to run away from a reality that they can't face. Here, Haman, the non-Jew feels it. All this is not worth anything to me. Not worth anything to him. Because this one Jew is sitting there at the gate of the king. He's sitting at the gate of the king. And he feels that, you know, if he's sitting at the gate of the king, then what am I doing? I'm a baby playing with toys. I'm not really getting it.
Even the word sitting implies that, maybe. He's sitting. He's relaxed. He's sitting here. Here, almost running around here, before he's going, he's speaking, calling people. What if I see he's just sitting?
Or Yoshev also can mean dwell. He's got a residence there. That's his connection. That's his attachment. Right? I think both are true. Yeah.
But is it your opinion that this is only the case with Amalek, or can we extend this to Goyim?
In general, to Goyim. And as I told you, certainly to non-religious Jews, they feel this right away. The most bitter and irrational challenges you'll get from it was Aaron Tversky, Yeshia Tversky's brother, whom I knew when he was at Harvard, and he got his undergraduate, he got his graduate degree from Loyola College in Chicago. At any rate, 1 year, he had a class on Friday afternoon, and it was difficult for him, and sometimes he had to leave early in the winters. Next year, the faculty was getting together to plan the schedule for the coming year. And one class was scheduled for Wednesday afternoon, late Wednesday afternoon. And one of the professors said, oh, no, we can't put that class at that time, because Tversky has to take this class next year. And I know that for some reason, late in the afternoon, he's got to leave. This was Wednesday, right? The last one was Friday. But this professor at Loyola didn't know the difference. But Loyola is a Catholic college. And they rescheduled the class because Tversky has to take it. And I want you to show me a Jewish professor who'll do that. Reschedule a class because it's got a frum kid in the class and who might have trouble taking the class. No, I want to see that. The only school, one of the only two schools in the United States that won't take credits from Rosh Hashanah is Brandeis University. Jewish school, they won't take credits from me because this study is not really study. This doesn't count. This is not really academic.
Is it that they know that it's really
the
truth, or they think that we think that we're better than them?
Neither one. They have a policy not to.
Not Brandeis, but when they look at us, they think that we think that we're better than them. That will bother them, or bother them.
I think there's a difference between the conscious level and the unconscious level. The conscious level, they create tirutzim. They create excuses. As Rabbi Ordman once pointed, a very interesting thing. The tension between religious and non-religious 120 years ago in Europe was worse than today, better than today, about the same. It was very bitter. I don't know how to judge which is more or less, but it was very bitter. You had non-religious who were infiltrating yeshivas, pretending to be yeshiva students, and trying to seduce the yeshiva students out of the yeshiva. You had the non-religious going to the non-Jewish powers and telling them to delegitimize the Jewish communities that were there. It was pretty bitter. In the Lower East Side of New York, on Yom Kippur, it was customary to take ham sandwiches and throw them in the windows of the shuls. I mean, you're talking about active, bitter opposition, right? There was no question of who goes to the army, because there was no army. There was no question of money from the government, which is false anyway, but there wasn't any question of it because there was no government. There was no kfiyah datit, there was no religious coercion, because there was no government that could prevent religious coercion. And the struggle was just as bitter at that time. So these excuses are just excuses. They aren't explanations, they aren't causes, they're excuses. What's really going on is a struggle for the Jewish soul. That's what's really going on. And they know it. They know it. And they are not prepared to give up. And of course, we are not only not prepared to give up, we're going to win. But this is what's really going on. So don't mix up the conscious level and the unconscious level. They'll tell you it's because you think you're better. But that's not what's really pushing them. Because after all, Catholics think they're better also. And Protestants think they're better also. And Hindus think they're better also. It doesn't bother the Jew. It only bothers the Jew, he says, when the Jew thinks he's better.
Some people, I'm always, I mean, even for me for a while, saying that you walk around someone's place because he's is getting nervous for some reason.
I'm going to leave that. You said it. You said it. Yeah, I didn't say it. You didn't ask me. You said it. Just leave that on the table. Okay, let's step up. Yeah.
So, can we learn anything from the King's Gate and the King's King's Gate and the King's courtyard, the court? Who's in the court? Like he's in the King's court?
By the way, I don't know. I don't know the answer to your question, but just be careful here. The Art Scroll in some places translates chatzer as court. I don't know why they would do that. Chatzer is a courtyard. Courtyard where you put in wagons, you know, or you might have a snack there. A court is the place where judges sit and pass judgment on cases and defend justice, supposedly, right? A court and a courtyard are very different from one another. Chatzer never means court. It means courtyard. So don't confuse the two. I mean, we don't use the word courtyard at all anymore. So you never know what you're talking about. But in one place, they translate chatzer as court, and that, to me, it's just another mistake. Okay, now let's go back to work. So, he's sitting there with who? With his friends and Zeresh, his wife. And he says, look at my problem here. I have everything, and it's worth nothing to me. Now look at 14. What do you see, boys and girls here? Boys? His wife says, and all of his friends. So the wife speaks up first. She's mentioned last in the people who are invited to attend the session here, but she speaks first, and they follow her. Let a tree be made, meaning a wooden structure, 50 amas high. How tall is 50 amas? No, amas are less than 2 feet. It's about, it could be 20 inches or 22 inches. Talk about 80, 90 feet tall.
Wow.
That's pretty high. That's like 8 stories high. Let such a thing be made. Passive verb. Okay, yasuit. They shall make, but it ends up passive. And in the morning, go to the king, and they'll hang Mordechai on it. And then, when you go to the party, you'll be happy. And the idea pleased Haman, and he made the gallows, the tree. Now you know, how do we get into this thing in the first place? He conceived the hatred against Mordechai, and it was contemptible to him to try to kill Mordechai alone. So that's why he made the plan to kill the whole Jewish people. Because for the prime minister to go after one solitary Jew, that was, you know, it was low. It was low. It was mean. It was something that was beneath his dignity to take notice of him. So that's why he said to kill all the Jews, right? So what's he doing now?
He's killing them.
Okay, but the Jews are going to be killed 11 months from now, and nobody knows that it's going to happen or why it's going to happen.
So
So what happened to the fact that he's small potatoes? He's too small to pay attention to. It's beneath his dignity to deal with it.
He's making an example out of him.
3 days ago, he hated him, and he said, I can't kill him alone. I can't kill him alone because it's too small. The prime minister is going to go after one sole Jew who doesn't bow down to him. You know, it shows that I'm a small, petty person. I can't do that. 3 days later, he's turning around. He's going to get him hung immediately.
The king
has to do it anyway. The king had to seal the decree against the Jewish people also. Nothing can be done without the king.
He's more important than
him. Mordechai?
No, Haman.
He's even more important, right? So it should be more contemptible. No, it should be more contemptible for him to do it.
Also, his anger is bigger.
Yeah. In other words, he can't hold himself back. He can't hold himself back. What 3 days ago he couldn't do because it was beneath him, it was too small, it was too petty. He's so angry now, he's overlooking that. He's overlooking that and prepared to kill him.
Or maybe he felt higher up now also because he got into this.
The reason why it was contemptible is because he was high up. The higher up he is, the less he should take notice of this insect, you know. The taller you are, the smaller the insect looks. that should have been the attitude. Okay, now comes the first open instance of something miraculous. That night, the king can't sleep. Oh. And he says to bring the history book in front of him, let them be read. That's to say, the historical events should be read in front of the king. Now, I always make a joke here and say the reason he wants a history book is because everybody knows that history puts you to sleep. Right. But that's only a joke. I assume that wasn't the real reason. The book does not give you a clue as to what the reason is. So, Chazal tell us that it wasn't just that he had an attack of insomnia. He felt disturbed. He felt something was wrong. And he, sort of trusting his intuition, if something's wrong, then maybe if I read the history book, I can find out what it is. It'll remind me. It'll trigger my memory as to what is... bothering me here because something's bothering me. Won't let me sleep. Yeah.
Because of the fact that Haman's coming and it's supposed to be him and the queen. It's rather him and the queen. And so now he's thinking.
Oh, so this is one thing that they do suggest. What was Esther's idea of having a party for just the king and Haman? Well, what's that got to do with pleading with the king for salvation and all the rest?
Two guys in.
No problem with Yichud. I assume that there were waiters and waitresses there and the musicians who were playing music.
But no, it's like there's two guys and a girl. Yeah, there's a guy. There's two guys.
Oh. So what is she doing here? Now take what I told you. Take what I told you. What is she doing here? He's playing on Achashverosh's insecurities. I must have mentioned to you in the last week, six times, what do rulers do if they want to stay in power for a long time? Which people?
The people who are trying to find it. No, the people who they feel secure.
That's right. The closest advisors. The closest advisors, the people who are the most powerful, periodically you kill them off, because Stalin did it regularly, because they're the ones who are in a position to challenge your authority or your power at a later stage of time, right? So what does she do? She invites the king and the prime minister. That has to raise questions in his mind. Why is she inviting him? Is she betraying some thought of hers? Is she now not publicizing to the world? He's on a par with me. He's equal with me. So already she's trying to insert into Achashverosh's mind that he'd better look at Haman with more critical eyes because he's getting too big. So she has her plan as well. And then this could also be what bothered him that night. Anyway, he had, but that doesn't explain the history book. So he opens up the history book. And it was found written that Mordechai informed the king about the plot against his life. Bigshan and Seresh wanted to kill him. This was 4 years before. And the king said, what honor and greatness was done to Mordechai for this. And the servants of the king said to him, nothing was done to him. I mean, the book has all the relevant historical events in it, and there's nothing there. And the king says, who's in the courtyard? And Haman came to the courtyard of the king, the outer courtyard, to tell the king to hang Mordechai on the gallows, the wooden gallows that he had prepared for him. And the servants of the king say to him, behold, Haman is standing in the courtyard. Now, put yourself in the king's shoes for a minute. Try to think like he thinks. Oh, I have to do something good for Mordechai. You have to do something for him. And the prime minister's standing outside. Oh, great. Great what? What would be nice about the fact that the prime minister is standing outside and you now decided that you're going to do something good for Mordechai?
You haven't carried out. Advice.
Well, advice. I think he would say, you know, oh, it's terrible. It's 4 years already. We overlooked this thing. Now, it's true it's a Jew. That's why I explained last time. Why didn't he do it when it immediately happened? Jews are a despised people. They're a low people. So to reward him might have political implications. You see that he's very careful about the political implications of everything that he does. You know, take advice with him. Would you guess that he's going to publicly disgrace the prime minister? Would that be the guess that he wants? That's what he wants it for? Oh, great! Haman is here! Just the man I want! To publicly disgrace him? And Haman's going to come to the party because the queen invited him. And the king's not going to cancel that. The king's not going to cancel that. But he's going to come disgraced. He's going to come disgraced. And then no one will have any question. Gosh, I wonder why Haman's at the party with the king, the only other one, in fact, and he's the prime minister, you know? Yeah, he's the one who was leading Mordechai, the Jew. Mordechai, the Jew, the despised Jew. Okay, saved the king's life. So the king is rewarding him. Very nice. But he had the prime minister lead him through the streets, holding the reins of the horse and proclaiming, this is what will be done for the person whom the king wants to honor. Right, so the king sees here a beautiful opportunity to take Haman down a peg, and thereby make it clear that there's no competition here. That's what happened. Okay, so we can go a little further. Let him come, says the king. And Haman comes. This is it. This is the end for Haman, the beginning of the end. But see, the book here now becomes very explicit. It doesn't leave anything to your imagination. We know why Haman was coming. But the book means to tell you, look at the irony. He's coming to kill Mordechai, and he ends up honoring Mordechai. Right, so anybody who sees that, it's the exact opposite of what he wanted to occur. So, verse 6. Haman comes in and the king says to him, what should be done for a man whom the king wants to honor? Notice, no explanation. I mean, if I were in Haman's shoes, I would say, well, why do you want to honor him? What did he do? Let's figure out a reward that's commensurate with, suppose this guy the king wants to honor is a scientist, and the scientist discovered some new weapon of war. So make him in charge of armaments for the war, or give him a great factory with which he can create these things or something. You know, no, just honor. So Haman says, who would the king want to honor more than me? So therefore, he doesn't need to know what the cause of the honor is. He believes he knows it. It's for me, because I'm a great guy. And he thinks up an honor that would please himself. So the king says, Haman says to the king, a man whom the king wants to honor, let them bring the garments of the king, the royal robe that the king has worn. Not one sitting in the closet, which is a new one, you know, that's been bought and hasn't been used yet. There's a rule, usually, with kings, that something that the king uses, nobody else uses. When the king dies, you burn it. You don't give it to anybody else. That's, you don't sell it when it gets worn out. Once the king used it, anybody else using it is taking it down a level. That's why in many ancient kingdoms, and I think in Haftal also, we had such a rule, that when the king dies, his wives cannot remarry. Once you've been dedicated to the king, no other place, you can't go to any other place. So he says, I want a robe that the king has worn. This is already quite a daring thing to say. Not just one that the king ordered and has been sitting in the closet. and a horse which the king has ridden. And the royal crown should be put on. Now, in Hebrew, this is deliciously ambiguous. No, shol can mean on his head or its head. His head meaning the person, or its head meaning the horse. Now, why would you put the crown of the king on the horse? Why would you do that? What would the message be here? And you'll see that when the king says that they should carry it out, he leaves out the crown. He doesn't mention the crown because that's going a little too far. You're going to ride on a horse. The horse is going to be wearing the king's crown. That's too much. That's already too much. All right, we'll continue.
There's a
guy talking
to auction dresses.